Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Andrew from Lambertville Legacy Group.
How you doing, everybody? My name's Andrew. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Jeff for asking me to speak. And sometimes when I speak somewhere, I get asked to come out of my area to speak somewhere. I always ask, is there a dress code? Because sometimes you show up and you're like, oh, I missed the cue. You know, they wanted me to wear a tie. And then sometimes people write back right away and say, yeah, suit and tie, please. So it's like, wow, all right. So I got to go up and I got like 3 suits and I got to make sure one of them is, you know, I wear the cleanest dirty suit. And I put it on and I go to the meeting and the host committee's like a bunch of young guys. One of them's wearing like a throwback Allen Iverson jersey and like a pair of dunks, you know, with like jack up socks with like Cartman from South Park on the socks and rocking tattoos. I'm like, huh, like did I miss something? Like, well, at least I'm in a suit and tie today. And I'm glad that Jeff was equally as spiffy today with his eggs and bacon button down shirt. Which I'm sure is a Ben Sherman. We'll talk later. At any rate, it's good to be here. It's always good to speak at a meeting of AA. And it's also nice to speak at a night when the Eagles don't have the Monday night spot. And there's some people in the room. I started at the beginning, and I don't really get too much into what it was like growing up because I had a good childhood that's probably not even worth talking about. I have a mom who's from Puerto Rico. My dad's from Ireland, you know, and I remember one day thinking, man, I'm half Puerto Rican and half Irish. I asked my dad, Dad, what does that make me? He goes, that makes you 100% Catholic. You know? So I grew up Catholic because that's the only thing my parents have in common. And I have an older brother who's now a member of AA. I think he has 7 years. My dad got sober when I was 6 years old after a couple of tries and a couple of rehabs. And so I grew up with AA members in my house growing up playing poker in the basement. And, you know, I don't know if anybody else here has family, but that doesn't help a drinking problem to know that there's a way out through family. It just doesn't occur to me. Like we were reading more about alcoholism at a meeting the other day. And what more about alcoholism is it's a chapter in the book that gives an outline of what happens to an alcoholic's thought process before he picks up a drink from a position of complete and total sobriety. If I have 3 drinks, I pick up my next drink because it's probably this physical craving. But when I pick up a drink from a position of stone cold sobriety, like, you know, I'm out looking for a job trying to get my life back together and I end up with a drink in my hand, like there's a process that happened. Sometimes the process is as simple as I don't know what happened. It was a strange mental blank spot. But an alcoholic like me from a position of sobriety will always return to alcohol, which is, I think, a position that's beyond human aid, which I'm going to talk about. But we were just talking about this chapter. And really what it does is it outlines all the things that are not an answer to alcoholism. All the things that are not an answer to a drinking problem. Like this guy who went into a bar who did it one time sober 8 weeks ago. He went into a bar and got drunk. And when they asked him, why'd you do that? Well, I went in there sober 8 weeks ago and I didn't think it would be a problem. Like somehow I can bank on the things that worked 8 weeks ago. Like I discovered a human measure that works. Now it's in my arsenal, and I'm combating alcoholism with a tool bag of human measures. But it doesn't work like that. He got drunk, you know? I did the same thing. I thought I could go to a concert. Like, oh, I've been to a concert sober, you know? And then I saw Page Plant at the Spectrum in Philadelphia in 95, and I blacked out. And it doesn't work that way. The other thing they were talking about, one guy was like, yeah, but I usually exhibit good thinking and judgment for my other problems in my life. Yeah, that's not an answer for alcoholism. Sorry. You know, oh, I have splendid judgment. One guy, I have a wife and kid and 2 kids of college age and I have a fine job and a good salary, you know, and not a cloud on the horizon. It's not an answer to alcoholism. I wish to God that it was. You know, one guy was approached by 2 alcoholics and they were like, if you have a physical craving for alcohol that feels like when you have your first drink and then you can't have your second drink, you feel like you're drowning, right? Because that's what somebody said that, my mind, like, that's how I feel when I have drink 1 and don't have drink 2. It feels like I'm drowning. That's the physical craving for liquor that, like, makes me different. Like, so yeah, do you have that physical craving? Okay, and then what happens when you're sober? Like, do you sometimes obsess about alcohol or do you just find yourself struck drunk? Wow, those 2 conditions together might place you in a position that you need a spiritual answer. Oh, well, no, I'm not that far gone yet, you know, like, okay. So then people think self-knowledge is going to be the answer for alcoholism, and unfortunately, in our experience, it's not. And it goes on and on and on, and all these people who think like, oh, I just went in there to eat, right? Like I had an appetite, it's justified. That's not the answer. I wish it was, you know? So about my story, like I had my first drink when I was like, I want to say 12 years old, and maybe even 11. A friend of mine's older brother had a party when his parents were out. I wound up spending the night. And when I say older, it wasn't like 15. He was like 17. So his friends were like, some of them were in their first year of college, right? And like they dressed nice. You know, it wasn't like kids in the park busting it up around a beer ball. You know what I mean? It was there was like people who were intimidating because they you know. They had a DJ come and set up two turntables and he started putting on good music. And so I was like hiding out in the back bedroom with my nerd friends, you know, like we were nerding out in secrecy. And this dude knocked on the door and he opened the door up, right? He was the messenger, man. He dropped off like Boone's Farms. He dropped off a bottle of brown liquor. I don't know what it was. It was like bourbon or whiskey. He dropped off, beers, and he had a four pack of Coors Tall Boys, and I took the four pack of Coors Tall Boys, and I started getting to work, you know. And halfway through my second beer, and about 20 minutes of time, like I just started to feel, like I just started to hear the music through the wall, you know, and I just started to feel totally transformed. And I remember it, you know, it was like this really big pivoting moment in my life, and I just like just got up and left the room and just floated down the stairs. You know, I always say it because this is how vivid it was. The song that was playing was Diamond in the Back by Curtis Mayfield. You know what I mean? And I just, Diamond in the Back. I floated right out of the room. I went right downstairs, started talking to girls, started talking to the DJ, started requesting music, started asking people what they were drinking, started to ask if I could have some of what they were drinking. And like I had arrived, you know, like that was totally not me. Normally I'm the kind of person who if I engage in a social interaction, I speak to you and it doesn't go how I think it should go, or I don't come off looking the way I want to look, or you snub me. I think about that moment for like 8 weeks after it happened, you know? And if I'm sitting in a, you know, and if I'm experiencing a power blackout, I'll think about that moment 3 years later, you know? Or if I'm in a car that's broken down, you know, or in an elevator that's stuck, like those moments never leave me, you know? And people are always like, oh, you're insecure, you're too sensitive, something's just missing, right? And one girl was like, you know what, here's your problem, you take things too personally. And that was like, my mind was blown. She was completely right, you know? And then like, it occurred to me walking away from that psychological nugget, like, what do I do with that information, right? Then I learned alcoholism and that spiritual malady is not about having a psychological nugget. It's about lack of power, right? I don't need a psychological nugget, I need a power to do something with that information, to actually change. So I continued to drink, and it really interfered with my life really quickly. And because, like, when understanding what it did for me socially, like, I just could not picture not having a drink and, like, floating down a hallway full of people, right? And, like, it would take about 4 shots of vodka before I felt like the world wasn't as scary as the world usually was, right? That was in the beginning. And then I used to have these, some kid, I don't know where he had a big thing of 6 packs of Crown Royal airplane bottles, you know, and like I would drink those in the morning, you know, like I would drink one in the morning leaving the house. And then, you know, it becomes 2 and then there's a progression. But I remember thinking one day, wow, my cocktail to get me right is like, costs like $3, you know, that's nothing. You know, because I knew there was alcoholics and junkies and people who had $100 a day habit and they got to have this cocktail and that's such a headache and wow, like what they got to go through, right? But I'm like, man, $3, that's not a bad burden to have, you know? This could work. And I remember that was the last time I ever really felt like alcohol had worked for me. And eventually I wind up missing so much school from having that first drink in the morning and then knowing like I'm not going to make it 6 hours through school before I can get my next drink, right? And then I would just have a detour and then wind up drinking all day or wind up not going in. So I dropped out of high school. Drinking just got dark, you know, like the people I drank with initially didn't drink the way I drank anymore. They started to, you know, raise their eyebrow when I drank. I remember one time vividly drinking a lot, and there was a person who had never drank with us before was visiting. It was a girl, so I was, you know, I was trying to be on my sharpest looking behavior. And I drank a lot really fast, and I was sitting down, and I stood up, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to lay down. And I just fell right over and just fell down on the ground. And I was laying there like, man, I'm so embarrassed. This never happens to me, and we got company, and here I am. And I hear her say to this dude in the other side of the room, what's wrong with him? And this dude said to her, he always does that. And I was like, that's a lie. Like, make a note to step to that dude later, because that's just misinformation, you know? And then I stepped to him later that week, and like, you know, why are you? I'm like, I pass out all the time. I don't pass, you know. He said, because you do. You know, and he started naming, rattling off times and dates and occasions and times they carried me here. And I'm like, because, man, I wasn't looking at it that way. My experience of putting a drink in me was different from the one that was really happening. At any rate, drinking started getting dark. And so when all the stuff started happening and school started falling apart, like I was drinking every day, and then it was a matter of, well, you can, if you want to do home tutors, you could do home tutors. So I did home tutors. I couldn't stay sober for the home tutors to show up. And two of them mentioned it to me but didn't do anything. One of them was this English tutor, and he was like, it's, you know, you're drunk, and you have to not drink or I'm not going to come here. And then it was two times later, I was drinking. I was drunk when he showed up. He said, I'm going to stop coming, but I'm not going to tell them why I'm not coming anymore. And then eventually the other two stopped coming. This is my junior year. And so I was officially like dropped out. And then I had to get a job, but I couldn't get a job because I couldn't stay sober. And got fired from a couple jobs. Was supposed to enroll for like the summer thing, get caught up. That never happened because, you know, you go out and you drink. And then one day I just had a big argument with my mother at home over something I was supposed to do. She's knocking on the door like 20 minutes past when I should have been awake. And I had a hangover. And, you know, we had a really ugly altercation, you know, and like I wound up hitting my mother. And I left the house. And I went to a friend's house. I drank. He gave me a bottle of Wild Turkey bourbon. I remember that. I poured like it wasn't a tumbler. It was like a glass, like from the cupboard. And I filled it up, and I drank about 3/4 of it. And it didn't. It got me drunk, but I didn't have the sense of relief. Like I was physically drunk, but it didn't give me the personality change that I was after. And that really worried me, you know. My father came home. He saw what I did to my mother. He called a friend whose house I knew I would be at. And he said, if you see my son, tell him I'm not going to treat him like a kid who disrespected his mom. I'm going to treat him like a man who disrespected my wife, you know. So that marked the beginning of me not going home for a period that was about 9.5 months, you know. And I was living in the backseat of a Pontiac 6000 LE. For the first 2 months of that, I went from house to house to house, drinking. And doing all sorts of other things. Like somebody says, I was on everything but roller skates. And I was going from house to house, staying on people's couches. Everybody got tired of me really quickly, you know. And another thing you read in more about alcoholism is inspirations, you know. Like this guy who says, suddenly the thought came that if I mixed my whiskey with milk, it wouldn't bother me because I had a sandwich a minute ago. And then another guy who says, suddenly the thought came that a highball would be nice before going to bed, you know? This is after they had both tried numerous times to stay sober. Alcoholics just live on inspiration, right? And I was just sleeping in the car one night, and it was dead of winter. I was not dead of winter, but it was early in the winter. I was freezing. Suddenly the thought came, like, there's all these shore houses that nobody is in the winter. So I drove to the shore. I broke into a house. It was a rental property, but they had a cabinet loaded with alcohol, and there was nobody around. And I thought, this is it. I have arrived. You know, that was the first time this is what I'm going to do. And for 9 months, I lived in the car. I took property from these houses and I drove it back to Trenton, New Jersey and Philadelphia and sold it. And I lived that way for about 9 months. And eventually, Memorial Day, the cop was knocking on my window, like, you can't park here overnight anymore. It's after Memorial Day. And next thing you know, the shore was just overflowing with people. And so I had to leave. And at that time, I had to have a lot of alcohol every day or I would get physically sick. And I was like 98 pounds. My hair was like down to here. And I hadn't talked to my family in like 9.5 months. Yeah, and I went to, long story short, I came back up by Trenton, and I wound up robbing a house in Yardley, Pennsylvania, and getting arrested like hours later. And what was funny was after I broke into the last house and tried to sell some items, it didn't work out, and I had this tired sense of desperation, like, you know what, I'm done. I'm just going to surrender and take it how it comes. So I went to my parents' house and just knocked on the door, like, you know, be what it will. I'm just gonna tell them I need help, you know, because and I need to go to a detox like right away, you know. And my grandmother on my mother's side answered, and she came to the door, and she said, "I'm not supposed to let you near this house. They're at a wedding in Long Island. You're not supposed to be anywhere near here. I'm calling the cops right now." So she called the cops, and I left there, and they followed me, and they pulled me over, and there was all sorts of stuff in my car. And anyway, I sat in jail for 2 days. I called my mother, which was Mother's Day, right? 1997, May 12th. And, you know, that's what they say in the big book, like the alcoholic has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment. Like not talking to your mother for 9.5 months and then calling her from jail on Mother's Day. Like that's the only the real alcoholic, you know? And she hung up the phone on me right away, and I begged her, like, "You gotta come get me, because you know, it's felonies and it's not like misdemeanors." And she hung the phone up on me. My father in AA called a friend of his who was director of addictions medicine in Trenton at Helene Full Hospital, and he came over and he talked to a police officer, and they got me a bed and they got me signed up with a treatment program, and they sent me to Effort of Pennsylvania, and I was in rehab for a while. And anyway, as soon as I got out of detox, I made an attempt to call these kids I was robbing with to tell them, like, if you don't bring me a care package to this rehab, I'm going to rat you all out and get a plea bargain because I'm still 17. And so one kid said he would drive from Philadelphia to Ephrata with my care package. And I snuck out of the rehab at night. And the reason I did that was because I didn't really know if I was going to just say, I'm not going to ever try to stay sober. For that day, I just could not possibly imagine going for any indeterminate amount of time without the island of comfort afforded me by a couple of drinks. It's just not even, there's just no realm of feasibility. There's no possibility that that could ever possibly happen. And the other thing that could never happen is if I don't have a couple of drinks to just think, right? If I don't have, like they say in the big book, the best, most majestic conceptions of man's thought occurred while he had a few drinks, right? Like alcohol inspires me. And if I didn't have a couple of drinks to think about what I was going to do when I got out of this rehab, I couldn't even imagine a life that would even look good. I couldn't even daydream one, you know? That's the problem with being a real alcoholic, right? Like, eventually you stop drinking because drinking is so bad and rotten. The addiction part of it is so rotten. And then you get sober and life is just so not worth staying sober for that it leads me right back to drinking, you know? Like, I regret the future. And what do you do about that, right? Well, I heard in AA, like I heard in the rehab, I heard this bad idea called good living. You know, all I knew is I didn't want to do serious time in jail, and I just wanted to make amends to my mother for whatever reason. Like it doesn't matter when I'm drinking now that I'm sober, like 8.5 minutes, it matters now, you know? I wanted to make a non-sanctioned AA amends to my mother, and I wanted to not go to jail. So I was like, let me just do what they're doing in this rehab and see what's going on. Let me open my ears and put the cotton in my mouth. You know, like, I didn't know anything about this here, these steps. I didn't want to find God. I didn't want a spiritual experience. I didn't even want to stay sober the rest of my life. It was, don't go to jail, get right with your mom. And I heard one guy talk about good living, and that became like the white flag of my early sobriety, right? Good living is like when you go back to school and you drop back into high school. So I went through the rehab. I went through all that. The guy never showed up with the care package. It was demoralizing. I didn't rat him out. And I wind up like going through the rehab, going through the motions, coming out, living in Trenton, New Jersey with my sponsor in his basement, right? Like everybody's early sobriety, you should be in a bunk bed, you know what I'm saying? That's just part of early sobriety. If you're in a bunk bed, you're right where you need to be at, you know? At any rate, I did all that. I went to the Al-Anon Club. I met a bunch of people sober who I didn't like. Somehow they were able to not drink 24 hours at a time. It sounded like they were doing good living. They were making alimony payments and child support payments and working jobs they didn't like. And, you know, they were doing their thing and they were making coffee and sweeping the floor and cleaning ashtrays. And, you know, one guy was like going to college, like, yeah, good living. Like one guy raised his hand at a meeting and he said, today, my driver's license, my car insurance, and my registration all have the same address on them, you know, and everybody clapped for this guy. I'm like, what the hell did I miss, right? And somebody says, that's good living, you know, like that's when you're in one place for a long time. And that's, we never used to be that way. And I'm like, all right, like, so I guess I got to get all, like, my driver's license straightened out, you know. So I dropped back into high school, good living. I started applying to colleges, right? I got accepted to Temple University on academic probation. That was good living. I was showing up for probation. That was good living. Got in a relationship. That was questionably good living. At any rate, I did get in front of my mother. I didn't do a formal nine step, but, you know, I agreed to follow some rules. Good living. Got back in my house. Good living. I went and got accepted to school, so I moved into the dormitories on Broad and Diamond in Philadelphia, you know, with a couple of months sober. Good living, right? Went right to a meeting before I unpacked because some dude told me to do that. Got a commitment, got a home group, got a sponsor in Center City. His name was Center City Raymond. He told me to get a coffee commitment, which I got. It was at 19th and Walnut. Good living, right? I got a girlfriend, like I said. We were going on vacation, which is good living, and we wind up going to Boston, right? And this girl, the whole trip drove me absolutely nuts, you know, because this is the dilemma of the alcoholic, is that when I put a drink down and I'm not dealing with the consequences of chasing a drinking habit, you know, the prospect of living any kind of a normal life, I'm just not built for it. I'm not built to think that way. I'm not disciplined. I don't have the power, right? Like I might do something and I like the persona of it, like, oh, I'm having a job, I'm showing up, I'm doing the right thing, right? Like I'm watering these plants and I'm feeding this cat, you know, like I like the persona of that for about a week. After that, I hate it all, you know, after a week, it's not good enough, you know, and I'm like, who's going to take this cat and like screw this plant and I don't want this job anymore. Or this boss just sucks and I'm not making enough and it's all meaningless. So what do you do then, right? So we went to Boston together, this girl and I, and I'm just going to paint, like, do this little anecdote just to show what it's like for me in sobriety. So we left in her Mercury Lynx and drive up to George Washington Bridge on Friday at, like, 4 o'clock in the summer. I don't know if you ever try to go up across Bronx. It's so much traffic. We were just sitting there, right? You know, and I'm cursing in the car like, man, we need a fucking helicopter, you know, like, we can't, you know, it was like 6 hours to get from Philadelphia to like, the Connecticut border in Port Chester. And I was like, so nuclear, she couldn't say anything to me. And like, I'm just giving her these, I'm just bringing her down so hard. And she doesn't know what to say. She's driving this car. We get to Connecticut, in the far ends of Connecticut, the car breaks down. I'm giving her so much crap about this car. It ain't my car. I didn't drive. You know what I mean? Just not being a good person, not being helpful, being very, very ultra negative, right? Just like radiating that toxicity and venom, you know? And so she calls her friend. They call a tow truck. Her friend meets us. I don't like her friend. I'm starting to give her bad vibes about that. When we get there, apparently we're not allowed to stay at her friend's apartment because her friend's roommate said, no, I don't want to have, you know, two people. The apartment's very small. They were like sharing a one bedroom. I was like outraged, you know, how could you do this? You got to make better arrangements. I don't have the money for a hotel. And she thought she was doing me a favor by telling me, yo, my mom is staying in town too and visiting. She said you could split her hotel and she'll cover it. I was nuclear. I'm like, I'm not staying in a hotel with your stupid mom and your stupid brother. Like, no way. And so we end up in this hotel in like Plymouth, Massachusetts with this girl's mom. and we have no car. And she's like, we're going to go to a wax museum tomorrow. I'm like, I kicked the wall. Like, I'm not going to any freaking wax museum. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not doing this. This is ridiculous. Like, take me back to the train, you know? Like, I'm going to hitchhike home. I'm out, you know? And that was funny because when I got to the border of Northeast Philadelphia and we crossed 95 at Academy Road, started to get my hairs on the back of my neck standing up. Like, damn, I am beyond the reach of SEPTA. You know, what am I going to do if something goes wrong, you know? Like, back in the day, $2 was a bus fare and a transfer. You could get from the Northeast to the airport with that, you know? And if somebody wronged me or said something I didn't like or I was in an environment that wasn't conducive to my comfort and sobriety, I would just be like, I'm out. You know? And now I'm like completely at her mercy and the mercy of her mom. I hate every second of it. Like if you had given me a gun, I would have blown my head off. So it culminated when we were, her friend's friend picked us up. I didn't like this dude. He had Birkenstocks. He had a hemp necklace. He had a fish t-shirt. Right. And he had a Jetta and it had a Dave Matthews bumper sticker on it. And, I just wanted to knock this guy's teeth out. And I was being so rude to this guy who was came to give us a ride, who didn't know us from Adam. And, that's when I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm going to call my boy. I'm getting out of here. And like outrageous, you know, and I go use a payphone. She follows me out and she says to me like, I don't know what's wrong with you. Like, you have this thing. Like, you just get so worked up, you know? This is out of our control. It's going to be fine, right? It's only a couple of days. Like, don't worry about it, you know? And none of that's doing anything for my malady, right? Anyway, this girl's father committed suicide because he was probably a candidate for what we all have here. And he took his life in her house when she was 14, right? And, you know, and I said to her, in the parking lot, the reason your dad did that is because the women in your family drive men crazy. You know? Like, you could read the big book all day. Like, that is not what they're talking about when they're talking about the life that's available to us by not drinking one day at a time. And I made a decision that I was going to end my life, and I hitchhiked to South Boston. I took the T to South Station, and I took a train on borrowed money to Trenton, where I bought a handgun by a guy who I used to deal with who was on the corner of North Broad and Warren. He had vampire platinum teeth implanted in his mouth, you know. And I stepped to this guy and I bought a handgun. And I went down to the tracks where the R7 goes from Philadelphia to Trenton. And I was going to blow my brains out. And it didn't happen. It's, you know, maybe another story. But I wound up going back to Philadelphia to talk to my sponsor. And while I was doing that, we were on the porch of his apartment building. He had one of those little three-story apartments on South Street and 7th. So you could see people from the street when you were sitting out on the balcony. And this guy I recognized from AA saw me, and he invited himself up, and he started ringing the bell, and my sponsor let him up. And I didn't like this guy because he wasn't miserable enough in AA for me to trust him. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was from the other brand of AA, of people whose drinking I didn't trust and I didn't identify with. Because they weren't edgy enough. I don't know if that, like, people had to be edgy for me to trust them. And this dude was completely open and honest, and he was working the program, and his shares were really, really left me mystified. And I didn't understand most of what he was saying. He was always at the diner with a new guy. He always had the little big book in his back pocket. And I did not like this guy, but he came up and he offered to walk me home. Because I told him I tried to commit suicide. He goes, yeah, of course you did. You know, and I would never imagine somebody would answer. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I hear you share and I know what you're going through, and we need to have a talk about what's your problem, you know? And then in the big book, they talk about a man's brain ought to be cleared from liquor before he is approached. And what do they mean, approached? They use the word approached a lot. Approached means a guy with an answer, armed with the facts, who's recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, is armed with an answer. He recognizes that there's a new guy, or a guy who's been in AA and is suffering in sobriety because they maybe haven't learned what it really means to be an alcoholic and to suffer from a spiritual malady. And the approach is made, and that information, that answer is laid at the feet of the person who's suffering. And that's what he did. He did a clean, 100% textbook style approach. And he got me when I was at my bottom. And he told me about the two doctors of AA. And he explained to me that alcoholism was a problem beyond human aid, and all the good living and human measures weren't going to make me feel any better. And eventually, that if I was the real alcoholic, I would fall prey to one of the three states that precedes the first drink, and I would wind up struck drunk again. What's the three states? One is deliberately drinking. Two is drinking on an insane obsession, right? Like that it'll be different. And the third is the strange mental blank spot. You won't even know what happened, and you'll just be struck drunk. You know, and it's not a matter of arranging your life to avoid that situation, right? And then he shared with me about these two doctors of AA, because I didn't even know what AA was about. He asked me, what's AA for you? And I said, I don't know. You know, you come here, you get a fellowship of people, you fill your time up with meetings and commitments, you know, and you try to make yourself not bored. Like, I really had no idea. I was like 2 years sober at this point. And he talked about AA is really, I'll break it down, that in the 30s, before there was ever AA, alcoholism was like the largest medical riddle in history. Since man first crushed grapes, there's a type of person who consumes alcohol who baffles the rest of the people around him. And for some reason, he can't control it when he starts to drink it. And when he stops to drink it, aware that there's a real problem with his consumption, that individual will always return to alcohol. They said it's about 5% of the people are just in a funky, queer class. That's what the words they use. And they said that there's no answer for these people. So, okay, what if you had all the money in the world and your pop was a bigwig from New York, right, and you had real resources? And there was that individual. His name was Roland Hazard. He was two alcoholics prior to Bill W. He had all the money in the world. He came from a big family. He was the third generation of his name. And he was a drunk embarrassment to his family. So they used all the big money resources. They sent him to the best answer money could buy in Europe. And he lived with this doctor for a year named Carl Jung. You know? And Carl Jung treated this guy specifically for a year. Right? And my sponsors painted it like, if you wanted to learn guitar, that's like living with Eric Clapton for a year in England. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of resources that is. And so this guy had exhausted all the best doctors, got no answer for his drinking, went all the way to Europe, to the top of the cradle of civilization. And after a year of treatment from the best money could buy, he got drunk coming home to America, right? Like, he wasn't even given a sporting chance. And he called the doctor and said, what's really going on with me, right? You're the best doctor in the world. You just treated me for a year. What's really going on with me? Really is going on with me. He said, well, you're a real alcoholic. I misdiagnosed you. And a real alcoholic historically has only one answer, and I have no idea how to give it to you. And that answer is a spiritual answer, because an alcoholic of your type at your stage in the progression has to experience like this white lightning kaboom style experience that's going to change your entire outlook and attitude on life. And I have no idea how to give that to you. He says, well, where do I get that from? He says, well, go to spiritual groups. So he goes to the Oxford group, right? So what's the best answer you could get for your body? That was Dr. Silkworth in New York. And Bill W. was in and out of there three times. And the doctor said, listen, alcoholics need an ongoing moral psychology after they're sober that I can't give you. Right? All I do is give you exercise, diet, belladonna, the same thing they did for me in rehab, minus the belladonna, right? Like, I wish that it was just a drinking problem, because I would have been 100% good to go out of rehab. But the reality is, like, alcoholics have this threefold illness that the mental part needs to be addressed once I put the drink down, right? Putting the drink down is not the answer. Putting the drink down is the elbow room to get the answer. And Jim pointed this out to me. So what happened? Finally, one alcoholic named Bill W. had that experience, that vital spiritual experience. And it came to him in the hospital in his third treatment. And he had an inspiration, an alcoholic inspiration, as he was feeling this unbelievable spiritual effect that was struck on him in the room. He said, I wonder if other alcoholics would want to have this. And that's why we're all here. And he set out to find other alcoholics who would accept spiritual help for a problem with alcoholism. And then eventually there was 100 of these individuals. And those individuals wrote a book that outlined exactly what they did. So now you have this, all right, you have a problem beyond human aid. Well, how do I get non-human aid? Well, I have no idea, right? It's like getting struck by lightning. There's no formula for it. Now there's a formula for it. And when Jim told me that, it blew my mind. Like, wow, this is really as simple as it is, right? It's just a simple 12-step formula for a suffering alcoholic who's done with his drinking and done trying to implement human measures to make himself comfortable. When that's exhausted, and like it says, when the alcoholic's really badly mangled, I might do this work. And he said, would you give me the honor to take you through that work? And I was like, yeah. You know, and I never felt that way. I was like, what do I do? He said, well, we're going to meet a couple of times a week. We're going to read together. You're going to tell me what you don't understand in the book. We're going to touch on some things. And then you're going to write an inventory. And I wrote this inventory. It's real simple. Step one, real alcoholic, physical allergy I can't control and is never going to change, right? Mental obsession that I have no power of the choice in drink. Third step, that's a spiritual malady. I'm beyond human aid. Will I accept spiritual help? Yes. Third step says, all right, accepting spiritual help means you're going to be willing to take some actions. You know, are you willing to take some actions? Yeah, I'm willing. All right, we have to write an inventory because for you to have a higher power, for you to have a spiritual experience, you got to get rid of self. I don't know if anybody knows what that means. I didn't know what it meant then. It meant that, as simply as I could put it, my experience in this universe had to change, and my experience prior to coming into contact with Jim and doing this work was I was out for myself. Every single thing I did, favors were really setups, and everything I did was for myself, you know. And then if plan A didn't work, on plan B I was more demanding or more gracious, whatever worked. But everything, every single thing I did, all I saw was my little scheme, my little outcome. And in that condition, I didn't know this at the time, but it's very hard to have a sense of grace that'll keep me sober. And he said, once we inventory those things, we're going to identify some things that you do or some defects that you might have, and then we're going to ask them to be removed. And so I wrote this inventory out, kind of a goofy thing, right? But one of the resentments that I finally had a catalyst with, right? It's so weird, like when you write an inventory, it's these four silly columns in the big book. I heard people say, I wrote a biography inventory. I don't know what the hell that is. You could read the whole book and you still won't know what the hell that is. It scared me because I'm not like, you know, I'm not a very, I'm not into homework. I'm not into big assignments, you know. But it says we're usually as definite as this example. And I could deal with this one. It's just four columns. I'm resentful at so-and-so, the cause. Affects my pride, self-esteem. What was the part I played in it? And it's really dumb, but I'll share it real quick, because it doesn't seem like it has anything to do with the drinking problem. But I write a resentment, and I'm like, I didn't play any part in that. Like, this guy rear-ended me. I didn't play any part in that. This dude hit me. I didn't play any part in that. She cheated on me, you know? Like, and I didn't get the exercise. And I'm asking Jim, like, you got to be out of your mind that I played a part in any of this, right? He said, well, what's one that's not really scarring you deep that you're willing to talk about with me and willing to, like, show me some flex, you know? Say this one. It was my roommate Jared. He stole all of my cherry Coke. And he said, well, all right, break it down. Jared drank my cherry Coke. What happened? Jim would not allow me to elaborate on the second column. He didn't really care the situation because I'm missing the point if I'm elaborating. It's just to understand in a general way what happened, how did it affect me, where was I at fault, right? And so this one he allowed me to elaborate so we could get to the heart of it. And in short, I woke up to go to school. Jared's throat was swollen. He was sick. He couldn't move. He had a fever. Good roommate. I liked this dude. I said, I just bought a 12-pack of cherry Cokes. Just, I'll put some in the freezer for you. Help yourself, you know. I got to go to school. I'll come back. I'll see how you're doing. I came back. They were all gone. And I was like irritated, you know, like he drank them all. Like I had a full pack. There was 12 of them in there, right? Like that's not a nice thing to do, you know, affects my pride, right? I don't want to be the kind of person that somebody looks at and says like I'm an easy take or I'm somebody to steal on. Like I want people to respect my boundaries, right? And then the other is affects my financial security. It's stupid, but, you know, like, if you ever took an $8 withdrawal from Philadelphia Federal Credit Union because you're a student, you know what I mean? Like, buying a cherry Coke is an expenditure, you know? And it affects my self-esteem, whatever, right? It irritated me. What part did I play in that? I said, Jim, I have no idea. He said, well, what did you say to him when you left the house? I said, I'm sorry that you're sick. I have cherry Cokes in there. Help yourself. And Jim was like, that's what he did, you know? And I was like, yeah, but Jim, it doesn't work that way, right? It's like, he's like, no, break it down. What do you mean? I'm like, well, you're just splitting hairs. No, like in society in large, right, when you offer somebody, it's something you do nice, right? But you don't take advantage of the niceness, you know what I mean? And he says, well, I said, Jim, right? In Puerto Rico, we got the saying, mi casa es su casa, right? I'm not giving you the title of my house, right? I'm letting you stay on my couch. You know what I'm saying? It's not, it's an expression, right? He's like, expression or not, like, that's what you said to him, right? So if you had to find something, would there be dishonesty? Yeah. Okay, so why did you say it to him if you didn't mean it? Like, what are you trying to get out of that platitude, right? And you know what's funny is it came to me right away. I want to look like I'm sacrificing for Jared, but I really don't want to sacrifice for Jared, right? And Jim was smiling. He's like, you want to look charitable, you don't want to be charitable. You want to wear that persona. I'm like, you're exactly right. You know, and he turned a stupid little resentment into a spiritual awakening. And I looked at it again, and he said, and why would you do that to Jared and not to somebody else? And the reason was because Jared and I hung out with the same people, and I want Jared to go and maybe say that I'm a good person. And Jim showed me a line in the Big Book where we do the fifth step, and it says, the alcoholic wants to enjoy a certain reputation but knows in his heart he does not deserve it. And then Jim said, I'm going to ask you to look back at your inventory now, and I want you to find any other resentments where that might be playing a part. Because now that I know that that's this thing that I do, I look down at my list and I couldn't even lift my head up, you know, because I was so ashamed. It was everywhere, right? Every single favor I do, I had to redefine the word favor. Because favor for me was a setup where I get something from you later on of equal or greater value, you know? And then I started looking at all my resentments were about me measuring every single thing I do for everybody and everything I got back or didn't get back. And the manner in which I got it back. I wasn't even aware. It was unbelievable. And all the resentments that I had, I was playing this selfish, self-centered part that I'd never seen before. Oh my God, what do I do with this? I shared all of it with him. Step 5, what do I do with this? He says, the beauty of our work is that you don't do anything about it. You ask for it to be removed. Go to the 6 and 7 workshop. They are the forgotten steps, you know? We don't do anything. We don't manipulate it. Yeah, but Jim, some of them are good. He says, take it all, good and bad, like the prayer says, because we don't even know the difference. We're so out of whack. Ask for it all to be removed. Okay, I'm going to ask for it all to be removed. Now what? We got to make a list of all the people that you screwed over, all the toes you stepped on, anybody that comes to your mind. Who'd you borrow a book from and never gave it back? Who'd you take money from? Who'd you make promises to you never? It was like everybody. There they were. They were all there. I've got that alcoholic memory. You know, I could build a case against anybody and remember the details. And here's step 8, a list of people. He says, one at a time, we're just going to get in front of them and chip away. That's the last wall between you and the power outside of yourself. Chip away at them. And I had a little envelope. I didn't have money at the time, but he said, just take 10% of everything comes into your pocket and put in this envelope. And before you take money out to spend it, pray about it and call me. And next thing I know, I had like $100 in this envelope. So then he said, all right, who do you owe $100 to? And I started making amends. And I'm like, you know what? The last house I robbed, I owed him for a broken window. I owed him for a prescription of pills that never came back. He says, all right, write the letter and come back and see me. And I wrote this letter out. And it was like, it was the worst letter ever written in the history of AA. I brought it to Jim. He was like, he said, Jim loves alcoholics, right? He loves like all the stuff we come up with, right? Like the guys in the Allen Club who gave me a triangle pendant that said GAA, and it had an indentation. They were like, if you stay sober when you go to college and you get a year, come back and we'll take you to Phil Pratico on Laylor Street and we'll get your diamond chip in there. Make it official. I came back 2 days after my 1 year anniversary. I found that dude and he was like, yo, we were completely kidding. You think that just because you got a year of sobriety, I'm going to outlay for a diamond chip, you freaking retard? You know, like, I was so embarrassed, right? Like, that's the stuff alcoholics think. Like, who am I thinking I'm going to get a diamond because I had 1 year sobriety, right, from these guys at the Allen Club in Trenton. Jim loves the stuff that we come up with, right? Like, for example, when Jared, I said, help yourself to the Cokes, and then he took all of them and I got bent. Like, 2 weeks before I wrote that inventory, I had 5 people in the living room. He came out. He's like, listen, I got school tomorrow. Do you mind if you guys take the party out of the apartment? And legit, it was 12 o'clock. I'm like, yeah, sure. He goes, you know what? Take my car. Go to Silk City Diner on 5th and Spring Garden, right? We were in South Philly. So that's like, what, a couple miles, right? Take my car. Go to Silk City. We go to Silk City. In Silk City, I'm like, man, we got a car. Let's go to Atlantic City, you know? So I go to Caesars. You know, I come back at like 5:30, right before he leaves for work, you know? And like, that's the alcoholic. Like, I don't even see that. Like, here, have some Cokes. Oh, you took them all, you punk, you know? And like, I took your car to Atlantic City, you know? Like, that's the insanity of the alcoholic. I am completely lost in self. Completely. So I wrote this letter that was like, dear residents of so-and-so road in the suburbs, I'm so sorry that I broke into your house and stole items. I've been doing much better since my subsequent arrest and you know, like treatment time. I'm even in college now. And most of the property was returned, but I know that I broke the window. I know a contractor in AA, and he told me how much it would probably cost. I've added a little bit to that and put in a money order in here. And also, I know a pharmacist in AA who told me how much that the pills would cost that were missing. So here's another money order for the script. And this will never happen again, and I wish you all the best of luck in your life. And Jim was like, man, you don't even know the harms you caused, right? You're not even aware. You're completely lost in self. And I'm like, well, you know, what do you mean, right? Like, it says, sorry, the window, sorry, the house. He said, see, you don't even understand, like, what it takes to, like, pay a mortgage in a neighborhood like that. You don't understand what it's like to have kids. You don't know what it's like to put your kids to sleep at night in a house that, you know, just got robbed. You know, they're going to go out and buy security systems, and they're going to go out and, like, think about moving neighborhoods, and they're going to start neighborhood watch, and they're going to be up at night. And you never were legally prescribed to that script you stole. So you don't know what it's like to have to go there for it and it's not there, or have to go and tell a story and get it re-upped before it's supposed to be re-upped. Right? You don't know any of that. You don't know what it's like for a father to have to explain to his kids or for the neighbors. You have no idea what you did. The jewelry you took, they didn't get it back for a day and a half. They don't know it's coming back. And you know, then I was like, well, Jim, if that's the case, you even make amends for that. Like, you know, I read the book. It was about a guy standing up in front of a church. Like, that ain't my style, right? Like, I'm not going to knock on the door. He's like, no, we're not. But he's like, the whole point is we treat it as we would any other matter. Now that we're connected to something, you just ask for what to write. And that alcoholic inspiration still works, but it doesn't work in the negative direction anymore, right? That's what step 11 is about, which I'm going to talk about in a second. He says, go home, hit your knees, or do whatever you do, whatever it is you're feeling connected to, whatever experience you're having doing this work, talk to it and ask it to tell you what to write on that letter, and then sit still and let the right answer come. And I went home and I hit my knees, and that's when I had my spiritual awakening. And, I felt completely in that one moment in my room. I felt completely unafraid, but not cocky. I felt completely, it was almost like the effect I had when I heard Diamond in the Back through the wall. Like, I felt completely free to, like, walk the earth, you know. I felt uninhibited. I felt unafraid. I felt like life wasn't scaring the ever-living, like, hell out of me anymore. Like, I felt completely at peace, and I completely could see what me going through somebody's life in search of self looked like. I saw it, and I wrote a letter, right, an appropriate letter, and I talked to Jim, and I called him, and I said, something just happened to me, and I've never felt this way before, but I feel completely, completely at peace. You know, I feel completely calm, and I feel okay, you know, and my mind's not being crowded by resentments or grudges or edginess, or I just felt fine. And he said, that's the experience that we're going for. And what you're feeling right now is temporary. It's going to go away. And which was kind of like, man, why'd you have to tell me that? Harsh my mellow, you know, like, but he was right. He didn't want me to think I was cured, because that's a common misconception. And then he broke me out, and we started living in the 80s, like it says in the back part of the big book. I had to keep my inventory cleared off by daily 10-step work. I have to pray and meditate. What does that look like for me? It means that in the morning, I think about the things that life put in front of me, and I try to just ungrip it, right? That's the meditation. Don't like, oh, I got to get there, and then this guy's got to be there. Like, if there's any of that, that's got to go. immediately. I just ungrip the day, and like there's 15 things floating. I'm just going to move towards the first one. And then it says if we are agitated or doubtful in that movement, you have to stop. Don't do anything. Like, back off. Like, stay calm. Forget the exact wording. Don't struggle, it says. Like, don't fight it. Don't plan B it. Don't plan C it. Just step off and ask for the next right thought or action. And then when I go to sleep at night, I just try to take 5 to 10 minutes to just let my mind be still. If I can't let my mind be still because of a resentment or a fear, I got to do that work and get rid of it. But then when I have a free mind, I start to get inspirations like I never had before. And then I start to live this life that's like unbelievable. I start just having this intuition, this simple idea, like, go talk to that guy, you know, approach that person, call this person. It's like a higher thinking. If the thought will be placed on a higher plane when our thinking is clear to wrong motives. I've experienced that, you know. Or, you know, offer this guy that. Like little simple stupid things, you know. I stop being afraid of a career, you know, like just do your work today. So you live like that, and then you're in front of people, and I'm able to sit still long enough to help somebody, which is like the ultimate payoff, because helping other people works when everything else fails. They say that twice in the book. Why would AA fail? Because I have divine dissatisfaction, right? That's what alcoholics are blessed with, the curse of divine dissatisfaction. We call it here the hole in the soul, right? But in reality, like, no matter how good my life is from doing this work, I will always return to a place where it's not good enough, you know? And that's the disguise for God telling me I need to do more work. It doesn't feel like a disguise. It feels, you know, it feels like this is a fated journey, but it's not. And as a result, like, I've had this life beyond my wildest hopes and dreams, you know? Like, I've gotten to travel the world. Like, I've been to a lot of different countries and been to a lot of different AA meetings, and have seen the fellowship, like, in a way that's really remarkable. Like, if you're stuck right now in Quaker Town and you're not feeling it, you're part of something so much bigger than yourself. Like, really quick, I went to Thailand and was just bummed out from a bad part of the trip. Wanted to be alone. Went to Koh Chang Island, second biggest island after Phuket, on the northeast corner. And I took a truck way down to the south end of the island. Just bummed out. I'm walking to eat. I get stuck out there because of a monsoon. I'm walking back. I see a little house and two guys out front talking, and they have an AA sign out. And I was like, are you guys about to have an AA meeting? He says, yeah, we are. Are you the speaker? I'm like, no. They're waiting for two guys on motorcycles who took the car ferry from Australia. You know what I mean? Like, and they said, come stay with us. Come hang out. And I spent like a week with these guys, and I'm still in touch with them. One's from the Philippines. One's from England. You know, I visited the guy from England and Ireland, and, you know, took my girlfriend to meet her family for the first time. It's like a life beyond your wildest hopes and dreams, right? And last thing I'll say, like, Mother's Day is a big deal for me today, right? Like, that's part of, that's a big deal. I'm sober 21 years, but every Mother's Day is part of my amends. And had this inspiration. My mom's retired. I said, what do you want to do now you're retired? She said, I want to travel. I'm like, you know, I found these tickets. I'm like, you know, I bought my mom. We went to London, you know, for Mother's Day. It was like ridiculous. We had the best time. We went to Mass at this church together, and we went and saw all these museums, and like, we just had a great time, you know. I just held every door, ask her where she wants to eat, take her where that food is, ask her what she wants to see, get her in a cab, get her on the bus, whatever. Like, it was just an amazing trip and a great way to be of service. And yeah, so keep coming back. Thank you.